Welcome everyone. It's 7 o'clock-ish. So we'll get started. Thank you to the people here who have joined us tonight in this cold, wintry evening here in Sydney. So I'm here on Barramadigal land in a place called Parramatta in deepest, darkest Western Sydney. And this land is the land of the Darug Nation, and this land was never ceded. So we always begin our events here by paying respects to the owners of this land, the custodians of the land, the Barramadigal people of the Darug Nation, and we pay our respects. And so this is a nice way that we can acknowledge not only the land and our complex relationship with this land, but also the people who in our culture have really struggled for so long to have the respect that they deserve for managing this land for so long. I gave a talk last weekend about Buddhism and the Symbiocene, and we're talking about living in harmony with the planet. And I remember I kind of said halfway through the talk, I became aware of how this idea was so novel, and yet at the same time, you know, humans managed to live in pretty much harmony with the planet for so many thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And it's only recently, in the very recent past, actually, that we've really messed it up. So this is something that Bhante, Sujato and I often think and talk about here at the monastery at the end of the world. And, yep, I wonder what the world's going to look like in a few years. So this is a happy way to begin the talk tonight. And I hope that you're all well there online and here in person. So Bhante Sujato, as many of you will already know, is currently away teaching a retreat in Sri Lanka. And someone has begun sharing this screen, so that's great. I wonder, looks like they're in Germany. I'm supposing that's our friend Messi, maybe. Anyway, I'm not sure how to unstop that. There we go. Okay, so we're still waiting for a few people to come in and settle. Hello, Eka. I'm hoping that there's people with loud, strong chanting voices in the audience tonight.
Well, if he mom had to go to.
So I just remind you, I have lost the ability, it seems, to mute people. So you have to be very careful on your own to make sure you mute yourself. Otherwise, we can hear everything that's going on, which some people forget about. Okay, very good. So we'll get started. I'm going to start by paying respects to the Triple Gem. So we begin with the Namo Tassa, and then we'll do the Three Refuges, and we'll do the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. I'm just going to turn this air conditioner off. Sounds a bit like an aircraft going above my head. Okay, are we ready? Yeah? So this is our segue from our usual life. We move from the banality and dreary worldliness of our everyday quotidian existence, and we move into a space which is spiritual, which is special. And so I talked quite a bit last week about how we mark this through ceremony, through ritual. And, you know, as Buddhists, of course, we don't want to get too ritualistic, but sometimes rituals are useful, especially to demarcate our usual life from our spiritual world. And we do this not because our usual life is not interesting or important. Of course it is. But what I'm saying is that it's very useful to carve out part of our life that is entirely devoted to our spiritual practice. And that means to be present for that time and to be careful about how we use this time, because it's so easy, especially when you're sitting at home in your usual environment. It's so easy to just revert to those habits of being that we all have. And I've noticed in the time that we've been Zooming the last 2 years or so, people always began very upright, very proper, very respectful of the Dhamma. They were really careful to make sure that they treated this virtual Dhamma hall like they would a regular Dhamma hall. And then slowly over time, I noticed people started appearing in their bathrobes, lying down in bed and eating their noodles, or talking on their phone, or patting the dog or whatever. And there's nothing wrong with any of these things. Like, they're all human and we're human. But how we bring our mind to this experience now that we're having, listening to the Dhamma, this opportunity, it's really important. And you won't see me sneaking off to have a pizza or starting to answer my phone or anything like that. Like, I treat this as a really special part of my life. And the same when I'm doing my meditation. I don't do other things. I tell myself, here I am, now is the time for meditation. And so these little boundaries that we put around our spiritual practice are useful because they contain something that's very precious. We want to make sure that we give this precious Dhamma time, our spiritual practice, importance and priority just for the next few hours. And it's really hard to do that. And so, yeah, we mark it usually with a little ceremony. We burn some candles and some incense. And then we start off by reflecting upon the qualities of our teacher, the Buddha, the teachings, the Dhamma, and our capacity to understand the Dhamma and to become a member of the Arya Sangha, the disciples who have realized these teachings for themselves. And so sometimes that's quite a lofty aim, but the way we're going to get there is by prioritizing our spiritual practice once in a while, once a week perhaps, or maybe more. And we're not going to get it by doing all of those other things that take our mind away from our meditation or our spiritual practice. And so let's begin. We'll do the Namo Tassa and then three refuges and the Anusittis. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammā Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammā Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammā Sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyam pi sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyam pi buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyam pi dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyam pi sangham saranam gacchami. Itipiso bhagava araham sammā sambuddho vicacarana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhammasarati Sattha deva manusana buddho bhagavati svakato bhagavata dhammo sanditiko vakaliko ehi passiko opanaiko Achatam veditapo vinyuhiti Supatipanno bhagavato savakasangho Ucupatipanno bhagavato savakasangho Nyayapatipanno bhagavato savakasangho Samicipatipanno bhagavato savakasangho Yaridanchattari purisa yugani atta purisa pukala Esa bhagavato savakasangho Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakineyo Anjalikaraniyo Anuttaram punyaketam lokasati Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So it's always good to recite the Dhamma. And now we get to practice some meditation. And so that's always good to do too. And probably we've left it too long in our week. It's always the case that we wait too long to meditate. And then when we finally do it, we think, why? Why did I not meditate earlier? What was my problem? What were the things that were preventing me from taking the time to work on my spiritual practice? What are they? What are those things?
Work.
Work, okay, yes. It is important to eat and live. So work is one of those things that does get in the way of our meditation. There's many other things. Like I don't work for money, but I do have activities that I have to do. And so these things sometimes distract me from my practice also. So I get it. But I guess this question is mostly rhetorical. What are these things that prevent us from doing our spiritual practice? And in my teaching recently, I've really been trying to get people to think about this because it's very easy for us to not prioritize our spiritual practice. And then we still suffer a lot. And we will then go on a retreat. And I had this experience recently where all these people come to do a meditation retreat and they come for interviews. They come to talk about ostensibly their practice, and by practice usually people mean meditation. You know, it should be a bit broader than that, of course. And so they come and they want to talk about their practice, and then they end up talking about work and relationships and their friends and family and problems. And these are the things that are occupying their mind. These are the things that are preventing them from having any peace. But one of the reasons preventing them from having peace is because they keep on allowing their minds to return to these things when they come to sit. And so this is how those things come into our practice and why I say it's so important to establish a container around our practice. And it can be just as simple as having that intention or that aspiration to just, before you sit, remind yourself, this is my time for spiritual practice. And this sets it up so that when these things from our life come into our mind, instead of becoming intoxicated and obsessed by them, we can let them go easier because we've already established this ground rule that this is my time for meditation. And we can observe these thoughts, we can understand how they come into our mind and where they've come from. We don't want to push them away. We don't want to force them away. We don't want to get angry at ourselves or anything like that. But we do need to understand why they've appeared. And knowing that there's a cause for them appearing, we should understand that there is also a cause for letting them go. Of course, they'll arise in dependence upon all of the busy things we've been doing in the world, all of the things that occupy our days. So they arise because of that, but they stay because we want them to. They stay because we're interested in them and because we're attached to those thoughts. You see how it happens when these thoughts come into the mind? They're so sticky. They just cling to you. You cling to them. And then you wonder why you can't let them go. And it's because you're still interested in those things. You're still attached. You don't want to release it. You haven't done with it yet. And you see they're so sneaky. Even sometimes when you remind yourself, oh, I'll just let go, I can't let go, you see them sneak around the back and come in the other side, right? They're so sticky and they're so sneaky. And sometimes you can watch them disappearing. And then you watch the mind reach out and grab back on and pull it back into the center of your mental world. I often think it's like those kids' toys. Have you seen those, I don't know what they're called, but like really sticky and you kind of throw them like that and but you hold on to it.
Yeah.
What is it called? Do anyone know? What are they called? You'd know.
Yeah, I don't know what they're called.
Sticky things. And and so this is what it's kind of like for us. And so these things trouble our mind in this way. Last week I spoke a lot about right intention and how we can work with the intention of renunciation, of letting go of that sensory world that we inhabit. And this is the basis for our intention when it comes to sit. We actually have to be okay to let go of that world for a little while, for a defined period. It's not forever, but during that time, that's what our aim is to do. And, of course, many of you have seen Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Brahm or Bhante Sujato give that very simple illustration of holding on to something, which is what we're doing when those thoughts are coming in and obsessing our mind. And it gets heavy when you hold on. And the way that you let go is just to simply release and let go. You don't need to push it away. You don't need to throw it away. You don't need to force it. It's just a very simple matter of being willing to let go. So this practice of renunciation, this mental training of renunciation, is powerful. And so that's the attitude, the intention, the motivation that we want to bring to our practice. And it's really hard because we think that that world outside is really important. We think that that's where meaning is found, where we, us, our personality, our identity is found. We think that's where happiness is found. But then when you come to sit, you see that you haven't got a moment's peace. And so we need to reorient our mind a little bit to understand that this is not where we find happiness. Instead, we find happiness not from holding on, clinging, getting attached, craving, but from letting go. That holding on is suffering, but letting go is happiness, freedom. So this is what we explore when we come to meditate, this taste of freedom that we can explore by meditating and letting go. So what we'll do for the next 20 minutes, we'll just practice letting go. It's so easy to understand, it's so difficult to do. And so let's take a comfortable posture. And begin again with that intention of just telling yourself, I'm here now to meditate. This is my time for meditation. Nothing else matters. You want to be here, no one's forcing you. And then take a few moments to set up your posture. Make sure you get comfortable. You're going to be here for 20 minutes. So find that sweet spot. And we begin really by withdrawing from the world. Sometimes it's useful to imagine the mind withdrawing. So we leave behind the world outside. And then we're just here in this space, this room. We're aware of this room. And we're aware that this room separates us from the world beyond. And so we're leaving behind the week, all of the stuff that we've been doing. All of the stresses, all of the joys, just letting them be. And aware of the room. Being here in this place. Drawing the mind away from the room to this body sitting here. Feeling this body taking up space. Feel the general shape. Feel the connection of the body with this chair or cushion, floor. And as you're aware of the body, how is it feeling now? How does it feel to have this body sitting here now? Maybe you're aware of the temperature, touch of your clothes, the pressure against your back or buttocks. Maybe there's some tightness or tension, an ache, pain, a little rumble in your belly. And so by leaving that world behind, by leaving this room behind, by becoming aware of this body right here, right now, we're becoming more mindful, tuning in to this present, seeing what's going on, and if you see there's tightness or tension, you can ask, what am I holding on to in this body? And sometimes it's possible for that tightness or tension to disappear just by inclining the mind, by recognizing I'm holding on here, and letting go, allowing yourself to relax, allowing yourself to release that tension, release that tightness. And so for the next few minutes, scanning the body, seeing if there's any tightness or tension, and giving yourself permission to let go, to not hold on, to relax. feels so good to relax. Holding on, tightness, tension. It's holding on to suffering. Happiness comes from letting go. Perhaps you see that by letting go of tightness, tension in the body, perhaps you see that already the mind has become more peaceful, that the thoughts have settled down. Naturally. We can relax our mind. By letting go of things that come. Gently releasing, not getting involved, not holding on. It feels good to calm the mind. Becomes more spacious. More clear. More powerful. So with this relaxed body, free from tension, and this calm, quiet mind. Return our attention to the breath. And it appears easily, naturally, all by itself. Suddenly, it's there, and we're aware, breathing in, breathing out. This breath calms mind even more, nourishing, and comforting. So easy, so natural. It's breathing in and out, aware but relaxed for the remainder of the meditation. And now we're coming towards the end of our practice. This is our chance to review. And so we look back and remember when you first sat down, how did you feel? How did you feel in the body, in the mind? And now, what happened, what changed, and why? Were you able to relax the body? How did it feel? Did you experience some peace? How was that? Were you able to see the breath? What was that like? And what were you holding on to that was difficult to let go of? And ask yourself why. Why couldn't I let it go? So hopefully you're feeling more calm, more peaceful. You've been nourished by the meditation. So we can dedicate the merit of developing our minds to the benefit of all living beings. Thinking, may all beings have the opportunity to hear the teachings. May they grow in the Dhamma. May all beings attain freedom. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. So for some reason I'm remembering an occasion when I got a massage. It's many years ago, got a massage, and apparently I must have been quite stressed. And the massage therapist ended up getting really irritated at me and kind of yelled halfway through the session. And he was like, dude, I need you to work with me. You need to relax. And I remember those instructions, you know, just thinking, wow, okay, like there's only so much, you know, an external force can do when there's this internal things that are happening, like that holding on, how we hold on to stress. It's the same with our minds. We've got this container of our practice. We've heard the teachings. We've got a guided meditation to kind of keep us mostly on the straight and narrow. And even then, you know, it's really hard to let go. And so this is why we need to train our minds. And you should know that it is possible to train your mind. And though it may seem challenging or remote, it is in fact possible to train your mind, which is why we're on this path together, right? Because we believe that it is possible. And certainly when I meet powerful meditation teachers, they always say, you know, I know how to let go. And so even if they have a lot of responsibilities and they're really busy, when it comes to their practice, they have developed this skill, this art of letting go. And it's something that we can learn. And so, anyway, I'll finish with that optimistic thought. And we'll be back in 10 minutes. I'll have a quick break. So see you then. So today I'm really happy to share something with you that has been rattling around the back of my mind. Well, I just turn this off. For some time, which is a new project that I'm working on. And I just shared it in the chat, and I was going to share the screen, but I can't work out how to do that. Is it this button? Anyway. So many of you will know, if you don't already, that I'll be moving on from Lokanta Vihara. Bhante Sujato told me that it was the world was going to end 3.5 years ago. And it hasn't managed to end yet. Although we disagree on what the definition of the end of the world is. Bhante Sujato insists that when we get given a pastry, it's a sign of the end of the world. So this is, and I say when we get given a pastry that the world is not ending because we've been given pastry. And so this, as some of you will know, is a topic of ongoing disagreement at Lokanta Vihara. So once I'm gone, can everyone please offer him many pastries? Preferably all at once.
How so, is that a sign of the end of the world?
Well, to Bhante Sujato, it's a sign that we're having pastries here in Sydney, Australia, and there's people around the world with no food. And he you'll have to ask him for his version of events, but his idea is that this shows the inequality, that when the end comes, the apocalypse, when the apocalypse comes, it's going to be this kind of fractured and unequal apocalypse. There's going to be people with, you know, the goods, and there'll be people without. So, and we're not talking about pastries, we're talking about water and food. And there'll be economic migrants and water migrants, refugees and things like that. And so this is the idea behind his thinking. And I'm like, well, but that's always happened. There's always been an unequal distribution. So the world can't be ending just because of that. And so you can tell this conversation. We've got to finish this conversation and move on. The point being, the world has not ended as I was told it would. And so now I'm moving out and I'm stepping out into the world. And it's not necessarily because of that particular reason, but now I'm what's called a Majjhima monk. Majjhima means middle. And so we have in our monk training, we have the idea of a young monk, a Navaka monk, and that's someone who has less than 5 years experience as a bhikkhu. And then, so they're like the trainees, the apprentices. And then the Majjhima monks, they're like the journeymen. They're supposed to kind of go out into the world and see what's going on, right? And then you have the terrors, the senior monks, and they, of course, are like the masters. So I've got 5 years to kind of, or 4 years now. This is my sixth reign as a bhikkhu, and 1 year as a novice, and 1 year as an anagarika. So it feels like a really long time, but it's just a short time. And so this is part of the reason why I'm stepping out into the world, just because, you know, you don't want to get too settled, right? There's a sutta about overstaying in a monastery. And it's like five drawbacks of overstaying in a monastery for a long time. Yeah, the sutras are just full of every single little detail you could possibly want. So this is, and in this sutra it says, first drawback is you store up a lot of stuff.
Like pot plants.
So I just want you to know that the pot plants that I have at Lokanta Vihara, firstly, they're not edible, so they would not be very good if the end did come. Secondly, they were all given. And I have not only kept them alive, but multiplied them. Yeah, so divided themselves, or bits have dropped off and I've stuck them in the earth. And so I've kept them alive that way. So in my defense, those pot plants have been multiplying, and that's why I have a lot of them. But there's other things too that come into your life as a monk. Robe material, bowls. These are things that people offer quite frequently. And I think when we first started, of course, Bhante tried to take stand against that. It was like, please, there's no need to offer these things because it's just two monks. There's only so much we can wear. We're only able to wear one, to have one bowl. And when we moved in, of course, we tried to keep it really simple. And I spoke about this recently. I just uploaded a talk to my YouTube channel about how we started off trying to keep it as simple and empty as possible. But over time, little things have crept in, And recently, Bhante Sujato seems to have relented, and we got a secondhand bookshelf. Previously, we had been using these wicker baskets that we found on the street. But because he's done so much publishing recently, there's suddenly all these books of different editions of suttas and all sorts of other things coming in. And so little things come in, and these things, just like the things in your lives, are burdens. They're problems. Every possession you have is a burden. Every possession you have is a problem. It's difficult to hold on to. They might break. You're worried about them. Someone might steal them. It's easy to get rid of stuff, right? I mean, look around the streets. You can see that it's quite easy to get rid of stuff, but that's the stuff that isn't wanted. Easy to get rid of stuff that's not wanted. It's quite hard, especially for a monastic, to... we have so little. And so the things that we have are important, or seem important, but even they can become burdens and weigh you down. And so that's one of the drawbacks. And I think you can all see this in your own lives if you've ever had to move house, how the stuff that you have, you're not sure who really owns it. Does it own you? So this is one of the problems of having stuff. It starts to control your world. It starts to control your life a bit. I remember my sister once having this beautiful big couch, and then she moved apartments and it didn't fit. And it was really hard for her to let it go. There was some weeks where it just kind of like was at this angle where she was just processing it. And everyone has heard of Marie Kondo and this idea of decluttering. So it's quite easy. It's actually quite easy to declutter, but it's actually hard to stop stuff coming in because we want stuff, right? And for monks, we don't really want stuff, but stuff still comes. And then sometimes it will come and we're like, oh, I might keep that, And then when it comes time to leave, then you've got to get rid of it. And it's hard. It hurts a little bit, right? This stuff is like a part of us. We're attached to it. We identify with it. And so we suffer when we have to say goodbye. And of course, in Buddhist thinking, like in the big picture, we're all going to have to say goodbye to all of this stuff anyway, because we're going to die. And you don't want to be obsessed about this stuff on your deathbed, worried about this stuff. And you hear stories of this all the time of people who are like on their deathbed saying, oh, don't let that awful Denise get my china. People are worried about this stuff. It's like you're dying, let go. And so as monks, we kind of are trained to think, I could be dead today. We never leave a monastery with our stuff in it, take everything that we own when we go. When I travel, as my teachers taught me, I just take my yam, my bag, and my bowl, and that's it. And we try to be light, because otherwise, you know, walking around with possessions is the very definition of being burdened. So it's the first drawback of staying in a monastery for a long time. You get stuff. The second is that you accumulate a lot of medicines. So this might not seem like a problem, but it's the same sort of thing. You know, you get a lot of stuff and you think, oh, I might need that. You know, who knows? Perhaps I'll need it in the future. So you see the kind of thinking behind stuff, right? Oh, but it's useful. I might need it. And sometimes you kind of create the need yourself. And so this stuff accumulates also. We're very lucky. People look after us really well. They make sure that we have enough RATs, as in the test, rapid antigen test. We've got a whole stack of those. We've got things like Strepsils and Panadol at the beginning of the pandemic. Everyone gave us Strepsils. Do you remember that? When we're all thinking we needed Strepsils. and so we, of course, use what we need. And if there's too much, we relinquish it. We pass it on. And so people might say, oh, that's terrible. You know, this was offered to you. But we don't want to store stuff up. We don't want to have that kind of mindset of, oh, what if in the future this happens? You know, we don't want to have that sort of mindset. And so we don't want to accumulate too much stuff for some future potential. And usually you see that if you need something, there'll be a way to obtain medicine that you need. But that's just one of the ways we practice. So we don't want to store up too much stuff. We don't want to store up medicines. And so we relinquish. And, of course, for our one class of medicines, tonics, we're only allowed to keep it for 7 days, and then we have to relinquish it. So that's things like sugar or honey. Yeah, or ghee, oil. We're only allowed to keep for a short time, and then we have to relinquish it so that we don't end up storing all this stuff. Like a layperson, you know, sometimes I look in people's larders, like my mother. She has, like, when the apocalypse does finally come, that's where everyone should go. So open up this, like, it's not quite walk-in, thank goodness, but it's chockers with stuff. And it's like, how could you possibly need all this, you know? And then you come to Lokanta Vihara, of course, we don't have a fridge. We don't keep anything. We don't have a fridge. We don't need a fridge because we don't store food. We don't have milk and stuff. Zero, zilch, right? So simple. Like you might think, oh, we're just city monks, but we are hardcore ascetics. We eat one meal a day. We don't store any of that food. It goes. We share it with the pigeons. We share it with the community center here. We share it with our neighbors. We don't keep anything. And this is a really good way to train. So that's the second thing, medicines. And the third drawback of staying in a monastery for a long time is that you become competent at, and you have many duties and responsibilities, right? You become useful. Being useful is a big danger. I remember someone once telling me, look, if anyone ever asks you to make a cup of tea, just make a really bad cup of tea the first time round. They'll never ask you again, right? But if you do a good job, if you became known as an adept tea maker, then people are just going to ask you to make a cup of tea all the time. So if you're good at stuff, or you're going to be well used in this world. And certainly for me, I've seen the way, just like those goods or those medicines accumulate, I've seen the way also for me that duties and responsibilities accumulate. You probably see it in your own workplaces, right, how these things start to accumulate, or with your family, You get more and more responsibility and more little burdens piled on top of you. And the, like with medicines, or, you know, I can't complain because people have offered all this stuff, and we always accept things graciously. But with all these responsibilities, most of them I think I've given them myself. And I think probably it's the same with all of us. We end up taking a lot of responsibilities and duties that perhaps we don't really need to do. And we start to identify with that part of us who is useful, who is competent, who is important, maybe. I mean, I don't know, really. Who cares about half the stuff that we do? Nobody. You know, you can spend hours and hours and hours working on a spreadsheet and they won't even look at it in the meeting. And part of us knows this, and yet we're so reluctant to admit that actually a lot of the stuff that we do is really unimportant and doesn't matter. And not me, of course, all the stuff I do is terribly important. And so this is the kind of conceit that happens when we start to identify with the stuff that we do. It becomes a kind of a trap, a kind of way of enslaving us. You know, I know people who are really good at cleaning their houses, and they maintain an incredibly high level. And, you know, they get really distressed if they haven't had a chance to clean it, or if a child has made some mess in it or left something somewhere. And you think, well, the purpose of a house isn't that. You know, the purpose of a house is to have a home, or that, you know, it doesn't have, need to be like a showroom. And yet we give ourselves these responsibilities and these burdens all the time that we pile up on ourselves. And so, like, I don't have a lot of responsibilities, but I have accumulated a few. And I realize just how difficult it is to give them up. I've taken them on, or I've been given a few, and it's hard to let go of them. And there's a pain. There's some suffering that comes from being attached to this part of yourself. And then, you know how it is. You change job, or you put some boundaries around your time, or you just give up. And suddenly it's not the same feeling. There's a difference there. It wasn't the actual things sometimes. It was your relationship to these things. And but I do understand, and I have seen this in monasteries and even myself in the time I've been at Lakanta, that if you're good at something, then you'll get responsibility, more responsibility, and that this can become, too, a burden or a kind of trap. You know, like, oh, I can't possibly leave. Who's going to feed the pigeons? Oh, I can't possibly leave. Who's going to water the plants? You know, these are the kind of thoughts that one might have, right? And so you don't want to let your responsibilities or your competency dictate your life. And actually, sometimes if you become competent, or if you become really comfortable, it's time to move, right? You've stopped learning. You've stopped growing. You've begun to seek out the comfortable side of life. And then it's so difficult to change. Oh, no, why would I leave? There's pastries, you know. I get such good food every day. Who knows what kind of food will be out there? And so it's important to recognize when to stay still and when to move, right? And so I'm looking forward now to relinquishing some of my responsibilities. And I've done it in a careful way. I've made sure things are covered. But I can already feel the freedom that comes from letting go. Maybe you've experienced it, like when you've quit your job, suddenly you don't care. Whatever. Whatever. And I remember once when I quit one of my jobs, I felt like this weight literally lift off me. And I was high. Like I could feel this expanse inside of me. I'd been so unhappy. And then suddenly it was like, you have no power over me. And then I felt really, really alive again. And it was very interesting actually to have that thing lift off me like that. So that's the third thing. You become burdened with being competent and you have many duties. I wonder if I'm going to be able to remember them all. It's been some time. The fourth thing is that you start to hang out and socialize a bit too much with lay people and become a little bit more like a lay person yourself. So this is a danger for monastics because it's kind of like that thing we did when we did the meditation. Like I said, you know, there's a world outside and then there's this world and there's the world that we prioritize. And by this world, I mean the world of spiritual practice. And there's a world that we prioritize as like our container for practice. And we put a lot of boundaries around this container because it's useful. It's how we prioritize our spiritual practice. But that kind of boundary at times can become a little bit permeable. And so you start to have conversations with people about things that are happening in their life and their world. And you start to get drawn into people's lives a bit more. And this can be a bit of a danger for monastics because you might start to lose focus a little bit in your practice, or you might think, oh, their world sounds really nice out there. Why don't I rejoin that world and enjoy the things that they're enjoying? So you can start to see how the more you kind of associate with different groups of people, you start to take on some of their thinking and behaviours. We're quite isolated, I have to say, at Lokanta Vihara. We basically have lived for 3.5 years mostly just seeing each other, especially through several lockdowns, Bhante and I. But even then, like, we don't see each other very often. You'd be surprised to know we are a little bit like hermits in that we have certain periods of the day where we interact and then other times we just won't see each other and we just pretend they don't exist. In a good way. Because that cultivating that sense of solitude is very important. And so being more in a kind of like an urbanized environment here, we do have quite a bit of interaction with lay people from time to time. And I don't think it's been a big problem for me, but I know that it has been a big problem for other people in the past. So this is one of the drawbacks. You become kind of familiar to a community and they become familiar to you. And they, you know, if they say familiarity can breed contempt. I'm not sure that that's the case, but I know that we might lose this sense of who we are. You know, monks, we're wanderers. We don't belong to a community. You know, we're not yours. We're free. We wander. And I remember Bhante Sujato pulling this trick, you know, many years ago. I remember the night he announced that he was leaving Santi and going back to Perth. We were outraged. How dare you? Who do you think you are? And he was like, don't rely upon a teacher. Rely on the Dhamma. You know, don't get attached to a teacher. Monks are wanderers. You know, I can remember him saying that. And I can see also now for myself the importance of not getting too stuck. And although, like, I, of course, I miss everybody and I'm going to miss you all over there too online, at the same time, the path is open and wide, and so you've got to walk, you know, this open and wide path. Can't just stay at home. That's why we became monastics, to leave the home, you know, to leave the home life, to lead a homeless life, right? Kind of makes sense, yeah? And so it's the fourth drawback that you start to associate with lay people in maybe not a very useful way. And then the fifth drawback is that when you leave that place, you'll miss it. If you stay too long somewhere, when you leave, you'll miss it, right? And your little heart will break. And you'll be sad, and you'll keep thinking, oh, that place, those people, they're so good, they're so kind. And so the Buddha said that, you know, we're not supposed to be too sentimental. And we understand that every moment is a moment where people could potentially be taken from us, or we could be taken from them, and that we can't become too embroiled in the idea of a place or feel that a place belongs to us, because that attachment brings suffering. So that idea of this is my place, this is where I belong, that's not true. And that attachment will cause pain. And so, you know, we train instead to have this sense of I belong wherever I am. Wherever I am, this is the place that I need to practice. This is where I'm going to make progress, not that place back there. So this is the five drawbacks of staying in a monastery too long that you, can we remember them? You store up lots of stuff, that you store up too many medicines. You start associating with, you become competent and burdened by duties. You start associating with lay people too much, and you'll miss it when you go. And so then the Buddha always flips things around and says, you know, so these are the five benefits of not staying in a place too long. You don't get too many belongings. You don't accumulate too many medicines. You don't get too many duties, right? If you, this is a good way to treat your work. Treat it like a holiday camp. Don't treat it like your job. Just treat it like I'm just here for a short time, not a long time. And, you know, don't do too much, right? You're on holidays. And then, you know, the fourth would be you don't end up getting into these maybe unwholesome sort of relationships. And, of course, you know, you don't get attached. You don't miss it when you go. And there's some other suttas, you know, where the Buddha talks about the dangers of wandering too long, doing too much wandering. And so that's also a problem. So the Buddha always taught the middle path, right? Like, it's like if you wander too long, I can't remember all of them. It's also in the fives. If you wander too long alone, you won't hear the Dhamma, you won't straighten your views, you won't, something like you'll get sick from wandering too long. And I can't remember them all, but I think the last one is you won't have any friends. And so if you're like one of those wanderers who just is always out wandering here, wandering there, then you won't have any friends. It's really sad because, you know, you need friends. Monks and nuns, we need friends too. And then the Buddha says, these are the benefits of not wandering aimlessly, you know, or wandering for a moderate amount, and, you know, you'll hear the Dhamma, and of course you'll have friends, which is nice. And so I've been very lucky in my wanderings to make friends wherever I go and to meet especially Sangha, who are always open-hearted and always welcome you back. And in that moment you have this real sense of connection and ease. And also the communities that I visited, even most recently when I've been away, people are so kind and welcoming. And sometimes you feel, oh, I could have been here forever. You know, I just feel like I've got these friends. And this is probably how we should always interact with other humans, right? You know? And they all invited me to stay, the places that I visited most recently. And I kind of think, I see what's happening here, Mara.
Yeah.
And so in the next little while, I'm just going to be a wandering monk. And so I'm going to be going away for the Vasa. So that's our 3 month annual retreat for the rainy season. So sorry to make this talk all about me, but I'm heading off to Thailand, which would be nice, right? Be good to be in a Buddhist country. I was going to go to Sri Lanka, but unfortunately I was warned off by the monastics there, actually, because they said it was a little bit difficult. And certainly I've heard some stories about what's going on there. I actually saw a photograph the other day of a nun who had been tear gassed at some protest. And there's a lot of food shortage, and you don't want to be a burden. So instead I'm going to Thailand, which is great. I'm staying at a monastery in the northwest. And that monastery, it has got a bit of an international vibe. There's some people who speak English there, and they were really welcoming. Contacted quite a few places. No one got back to me except this one, and they've been so easy. So I'm really looking forward to that. Just 3 months to really practice meditation. And it's not that I don't do that already, but it's always good to have a rains retreat and to have 3 months of really intensive practice. So if any of you have ever benefited from a weekend retreat, you can only imagine the kind of benefits that come from doing a long retreat. You always get such, nice meditation on a long retreat. And so that's what I'm doing. And then after that, I'm going to keep wandering for a bit. So usually after you do a rains retreat, you'll go on what's called like a tudong. So you'll kind of do some itinerant wandering around and go from place to place because you've been cooped up for 3 months, right? This 3 months is a long time for Buddhist monastics. At the time of the Buddha, people were wandering all the time. They were rarely settled. And at that time of the year, of course, when it's raining, the lay people wanted the monks to stay in the one place and not damage the plants and crops. And so the Buddha said, okay, for 3 months you have to stay in one spot. But then after that, everyone scatters. And so this is a good sign, right, of a kind of healthy community. You spend some time together, you get along well, and then you move on. And so I'll be spending some time in Thailand and then going to Singapore and Malaysia. And just to let you all know, I haven't actually made any plans. So if you have any contacts in Malaysia or Singapore, you should let me know, because I'll have to firm something up eventually, I guess. But I'm just hoping that when you make a decision to step out into the world and to abandon some of that fear that comes with change, or that trepidation that comes from the unknown. This is how it is meant to be for monastics. We live like this with fearlessness. We walk out the door every day for Pindapada not knowing if we'll eat. You know, and from time to time I do things like go to new places and just try my luck, and it always seems to work. And so in the same way, I think that when I step out the door and into the world, then who knows, opportunities might happen, you meet different communities. So not having a plan is my plan. And then when I return, which will be in about 6 months' time, I won't be coming back to Lakanta, because I'm moving on, right? Yeah. You can't go back. And it's not that I don't want to come back. It's that I need to keep moving forward. And so that's why I'll be starting up a new project called Little Dust. And so I just shared it with the group a while back. I guess I can copy it again. This is an idea that I've been having for some time, especially working in places where the communities are quite remote or regional and they don't have a lot of access to the Dharma. So we're quite spoiled for choice in Sydney, and perhaps that's sometimes reflected in our attitude towards the teachings. You might think, oh, I won't go today, I'll go next week. And who knows if next week will come. But do you realize how lucky you are to have a community that meets every week? It's incredibly fortunate. And in Sydney, I know you people online and also here in the room. You go to other places too, right? That's okay. I'm not jealous. You can see who you want. We'll have an open relationship. But the point is you have all these choices. And even if it's online, then, you know, there's a certain goodness that comes from online interactions like this. But for people living in remote regional areas, this is not very satisfying in the long run. We do this because we know that we can eventually go back to our communities wherever they are, and that we can access local centres when we want to, temples, monasteries. When we're ready, they're there, right? You've got to make sure that you support them when you're not there too, otherwise they won't be there when you want them. So this is an important thing for us to all remember. We have to keep on supporting these places, otherwise they won't exist. So never take them for granted. They need support. And certainly out in regional areas, there are no centres. There are no temples. There are no monasteries. There are no teachers. And so part of the inspiration behind Little Dust was to be able to go out to regional centres like Dubbo, Bathurst, Wagga Wagga, up to Queensland, back to Rockhampton and Cairns and places like this, where people are so thirsty for the Dharma but have so little access. And, you know, we're so fortunate to have such access to the Dharma. I hope you're still thirsty. Maybe we should kind of go on strike or something and get people's appetite for Dharma really wet. But so this is part of the inspiration. And, of course, some of you might have seen the logo. You can all look on your phones if you want. For Little Dust, it's kind of this burnt orange. And that burnt orange is representing not only monastic royalty but also the earth of regional Australia, that beautiful red earth. And so Little Dust is, maybe you've heard these words before in Buddhist teachings. So it comes from this quote that there are beings with little dust in their eyes. And this is when, after the Buddha had attained enlightenment, he's sitting there blissing out and he's thinking, should I teach? And he's like, well, actually the Dharma is really profound and really deep and hard to see, difficult to understand, and people just won't get it. They won't get it. So I'm not going to teach. It'd be too difficult and too vexatious. Why should I? And so he was going to become what we call a Pacheka Buddha, a private Buddha or a silent Buddha. That is someone who has realized Nibbana but doesn't teach. They might not have the capacity to teach, or they just might think, can't be bothered. And so they don't teach. So they're not a Sama Sambuddho. They're a Pacheka Buddha. But a Sama Sambuddho is someone who, like Shakyamuni Buddha, that realizes the teaching for himself, discovered it for himself, and then was capable of teaching and leading other beings towards enlightenment. Whereas those Pacheka Buddhas, because they're private and silent, they may not be able to lead any beings except by example of you know, sitting and meditating all day. And so the Buddha decided not to teach. And then the Brahma Sahambati saw this from the Brahma realm, because the Buddha's enlightenment was so powerful, it reached all the way up. News of this spread very quickly, even into the Brahma realms, into the heavenly realms. And seeing that the Buddha was thinking about not teaching, the Brahma rushed down to earth and said, "Let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma." And he said, "There are beings with little dust in their eyes." Apart Rajaka, little dust. Raja is dust or dirt. Doesn't have quite the same poetic effect, does it? Dirt, little dirt in their eyes. But Raja is like an impurity or a defilement or an impediment. And upper is small, something small, aparajika. And so there are beings with little dust in their eyes who will understand the Dhamma. And the Buddha was moved by this idea of compassion and surveyed the world and seeing with his vision that, yes, there are beings with little dust in their eyes. There are beings with, I'm not going to look at anyone in particular in this room. There are beings with a lot of dust in their eyes, and there are some who would understand. And so this is why he decided to teach. So he had the wisdom, he had the insights, and he had the compassion to teach. And this is, we chant a little bit of this really in a way. We chant Anuttaro Purusa Dhamma Sarati Satta Deva Manusanam. And so this means that he is the incomparable, the supreme guide for those who wish to be trained, for those who are capable, who want to train in developing their mind. He's the teacher of gods and humans. And so he was capable of doing this for those who wished, you know, for those who have little dust in their eyes, essentially. We also have this in the recollection of the Dhamma, that this is for people who just trying to remember the last line. Svakata bhagavato dham santitika kalaka ehipasaka omanaka pachatang veditabo vinyuhi. This is for people who are wise enough to see the Dhamma. This Dhamma is able to be seen by people who are wise enough to see it, right? So this is, again, this idea of having little dust in your eyes. And, of course, this dust, and this is what I've been talking about the whole time tonight, even from the very beginning, the stuff that clings to us, that covers us, is dust. All of those things in our life, this is stuff that is like dust thrown up over us and controls us, you know, impedes our progress, gets in our eyes and stops us from seeing. Those things that we hold on to, those things that we think are important, those things that we think are us or our possessions or define us, this is dust. And you go around your house, all those possessions, you know, they get dusty and it clings. And it feels dirty and gritty and uncomfortable, right? And this is the stuff of our life as well, the dust that clings to us. This is the stuff that we try to shake off. And so that's why in suttas like the Chulahatipadopama Sutta, the sutta about the elephant's footprint, We see this image in the gradual training. We hear this phrase, the householder life is cramped and dusty. cramped and dusty. It's small, and it's got that gritty covering to it. And why don't I go through the open road, ordain, and so this is the aspiration of moving from that dusty world, the stuff that kind of settles on us, and becoming more open to the life of freedom, a life free from dust. And actually being freed from dust is a synonym in the suttas for someone who is enlightened, that they've shaken off this dust and they're free from dust. And so this is how dust is used in the suttas. It's also, you see it in other places. I'm just thinking of a couple of similes. One is a beautiful simile of a bird shaking off dust. And this is how we should be. You know, we should shake off the dust of the world and focus on our spiritual practice. This is one. And another is the image of the dust settling because of rain. You know, all the dust that's in the air on a really hot kind of blowy day. When it rains, that rain just settles the dust. And maybe you've experienced that somewhere in the world in your life, that feeling of everything just becoming clean and pure. And this is a metaphor for meditation. This is how you find peace. This is that peace that comes from our practice when we sit and we meditate, where drenching the mind in this beautiful Dhamma, you know, soaking our dusty minds, and all of those things that cling to us start to drop away and are cleansed. And so this is the part of that process of purification of the mind. And the image is that beautiful image of the rain settling those dust clouds. And so this is why I chose the name Little Dust, because I thought it was kind of a bit cute, but also incredibly meaningful and profound. And after meeting so many people recently in regional areas, who were so thirsty for the Dhamma, I remember thinking, you know, they're really a little bit, a bit desperate, you know. They have no access to teachings. They don't even often know how to access teachings online. They're just not part of a community. They're very much isolated and spiritually alone. And, you know, these people, if they don't hear the Dhamma, then they may not progress, right? You know, for us here online or in this room, if you don't hear the Dhamma today, you'll hear it tomorrow or next week. But for people in rural areas, there's no teaching coming until the next time someone country towns, but actually I've been living in an urban environment for a few years now, and I look forward to seeing some horizons and open skies, and but there's a bit of reluctance there, and I don't want to say it's like the Buddha refusing to teach, but I can understand it would be a little bit vexatious, you know. I have to put up with different things. But that's what I'm going to try to do. So I hope you can support me in that. And so I invite you to check out the website that I've put together in the last few days.
Link.
Littledust.org. I'll put it in the Signal chat group already today. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. But you can just Google now, yeah. Little Dust, because I've worked out SEO.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh. The journey I've been on. And so you can have a look at that. I'll update it from time to time and let you know what I'm up to. Some people have been asking how they can support, and there is a page there if people want to donate as well. And so that's going to be my project when I return from my travels after a long time, a couple of months away. So I will go to the countryside eventually, but in the meantime, I'm going to go and do a retreat. And that retreat is really important for me. Shake off the dust, right? This is what you do when you go on a retreat. You kind of shake it off. You shake off all the stuff that has been clinging to you. And for me, it was really important to have a little bit of a reset, and to go away, focus my practice, try some new things, and come back hopefully a little bit wiser and to start something new. So I just want to thank you all here online in this room for being good spiritual friends to me and supporting me, and especially to all those people, got it? Great, who offer dana regularly and keep me fed. Like, you have a very special place in my stomach or in my heart, whichever. And thank you to Deepika and Radha who invited Bhante Sujata here. So it's, you know, it's really important thing people should know. If you don't know already, it's, you have to invite the Sangha. They don't just turn up, and when you invite, you have to support, right? You can't just say come and then not look after them. We're a little bit like children in some ways, you know. I said we were hardcore ascetics, but we still need to eat. And you know, we need support. That's our reciprocal relationship. And so, like, if you invite, you support. And I think Bhante felt very confident coming here, that he'd been invited, and that there was a community of people that were going to support him and me by default. And so I've enjoyed that support, and I can see how powerful it is for people to develop in their practice. And I feel like because of that opportunity, I've had incredible growth as a monk. And so that growth is largely thanks to your kindnesses. And so I just want to express that gratitude and not get teary. And I think I have to be here next week, actually, so this isn't the big hurrah, but I just wanted to let you know about Little Dust and to put it out into the world, because it's something that I want to see happen, and I hope that our community of friends around the world and wherever you are can help make it happen somehow, even just by telling people it exists or just by pressing like on Facebook or something to make me feel like I'm not shouting into the void. And so I guess it's been a bit of a rambling talk, and thank you for listening, and I hope that something has been useful to some of you. And I look forward to being with you all again next week, and it's probably the last time I'll see you for ages, so look forward to the pleasure of seeing you. Okay, sorry, no time for questions. I'm taking questions, and I'll see you soon.